the courts, there are some new ways based on technologies to distinguish the criminal ones from the innocent ones.
Mm-hmm.
There are some technologies to tell you if that person is telling you lies, for example.
Yeah, lie detectors.
Exactly. Now, this narration is telling us that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is, through the face of the people, is able to realize which one is his enemies and who is his
friend. So he has this God-given insight in which he, through which he could distinguish.
Or some people might say that Imam Mahdi is not in need of that knowledge of the unseen. New technologies help Imam Mahdi alayhi salam not to just, I mean, to tell them, the people, that this is the reality based on the technology that you may also have access to. Because we said that many of the technologies will be discovered and revealed
will
by Imam
flourish
Mahdi
after
Islam.
His reappearance.
Exactly. So there might be many, many other ways that nowadays we may not even think of.
For
but
sure,
after the reappearance of Mahdi al-Islam, new ways might be revealed by him to tell you in the course which one is with the truth and which one is telling you the lie. So both of them are possible. Maybe Imam Mahdi al-Islam is acting upon his knowledge of the unseen, or the ordinary knowledge, which
or the facilities that are going to be provided
and
back
they are revealed
in time.
By Imam Mahdi al-Islam.
So thank you. We were talking about the fair judgments of Imam Mahdi ajalallahu farajah. And we went through so much of narrations that Dr. Karimi provided with. Thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's session. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah bless you all. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest road?
Turkmans in Iran. Years have passed since the day Agha Muhammad Khan Qajar designated Tehran as the capital of Iran. During the past 251 years, the population of the city has grown day by day. Besides me, there are 12,399,999 other people who reside in Tehran. For various reasons, Tehran has been the destination for many migrating ethnicities in different eras. Turks, Lors, Kurds, Baluchis, Arabs, Fars, Shias, Sunnis, Jews, Armenians, Zoroastrians, and in short, hundreds of customs and traditions and millions of views are living side by side in this metropolitan city of 13 million people. The interesting thing is these ethnicities still have their own traditions even after so many years of living in Tehran. For example, the Turkmens, they've been seen on many occasions in different parts of the city. They resemble the people in East Asia, and their special costumes have always caught my attention. I wonder how they've managed to preserve their own authenticity among the myriad of different styles, or how they've managed to adapt themselves with this society, with this cultural and political structure, where they are considered a minority group. Years ago, after the Safavid dynasty was toppled, Turkmens migrated to the lush green regions in the northeastern Iran and settled down near Gorgan. The Turkmens were mostly nomads and would migrate to different parts in different seasons, but as time went by, they chose a different lifestyle, sedentism. The main population of Turkmens is concentrated in Turkmenistan, but you can find other clans of Turkmens in other countries like Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. The Turkmens in Iran are divided in three main clans, namely the Tekkes, the Gukhlans, and Yomuts. Each of these clans is comprised of different ethnicities. The population of Turkmens in Iran is about 2 million people. Many big cities are known for the people in the world with symbols. For example, the Eiffel Tower in Paris, France, or the Statue of Liberty in New York, the U.S., or Burj Al Arab in Dubai, or our own Siyosipol in Isfahan. And this is Gumbad. Gumbad is a 60-meter tower made with bricks. For the existence of the very tower, the city was named Gumbad Kavus. The majority of the people in the city are Sunni Muslims and Turkmens. Color, color, and yet more color. It seems the people here love colors. You can see any color you've seen in nature on the clothes of the Turkmen people. Red, green, yellow, blue. Thanks to the colors, people look fresh. Wherever in the city I went, I only saw the smiles on the people's faces. The Turkmens who follow Hanafism as their faith do not usually save their money. The important thing for them is to live a better life and enjoy the money they earn. They take advantage of the smallest opportunities to be happy. They're very friendly and real believers. When it comes to religious obligations, they're very committed people. Almost all Turkmens in Iran are Hanafis. Hanafism is one of the branches of Sunniism in Islam. The denomination has the largest number of followers among the four sects of Sunnis. Anyone can easily find these facts on the internet. I was looking for something else. I was looking for life. I really wanted to know how the Hanafis in northeastern Iran, or I'd better say the Turkmens, live. How did they manage to fend for themselves in Iran, where the majority of people are Shias? That's why I traveled to Gumbad Kavus and the adjacent cities several times. I got to know many people. One of those people was Mr. Niazi. He became the subject of my documentary. I'll start with my latest trip in March, when Mr. Niazi had just come back from the Hajj pilgrimage. As the Hanafi Turkmens are considered a minority in Iran, the Shias residing in this region are also considered a minority. But the Shia and Sunni Turkmens have managed to come up with a rule after years of coexistence, and that is respecting one another's beliefs. For example, here. This place is Imamzadeh Yahya's shrine. Imamzadeh Yahya was one of the descendants of Imam Ali. It is a pilgrimage site for the Shia minority in Gumbad Kavus, but it doesn't seem that it makes that much difference for the people in this region. I mean, the Shias and Sunnis stand behind the Zari, that's the lattice structure, in the shrine and ask Imamzadeh to fulfill their wishes. my last trip to the northeast of Iran, Mr. Niazi and I went somewhere that was really interesting to me, the Qalicheshan Seminary School. It's about 80 kilometers away from Gombat Kavus. When I looked at the structure from a distance, it didn't seem to be something new for me. I had already seen similar structures in other parts of Iran, but there were two things that were very interesting. First, in most of the villages around Gombad, there are similar mansions that are considered seminary schools in the villages. Secondly, the numbers and figures used in the structure. Every brick in this seminary school is laid based on some principles and accurate calculations. There are four minarets that are built to represent the four Sunni caliphs. There are 23 chambers that stand for the 23 years that it took for the Quran to be revealed. Each chamber has 6,236 bricks representing the 6,236 holy verses of the Holy Quran. To reach the Grand Master's office, you have to go up 12 steps. The 12 steps are built with the 12 Shia Imams in mind. The mansion was constructed about 150 years ago by Mr. Qalicheshan, an outstanding Sunni figure back then. In his trip to Mecca, Qalicheshan was respected by the Ottoman government. The Ottoman ruler, as a respect for the Sunnis in the neighboring Shia country, offered him help. Qalicheshan brought some architects to the region and paid the expenses for the construction of the mansion with the help of the Ottoman government in order to promote the Sunnis. A few years ago, a grand mosque was built next to the Qalicheshan Seminary School. The mosque's capacity is more than the population of the village. A few kilometers away from the Qalicheshan building, there is a city called Kalale. It has a seminary school as well. Quran recitation competitions are held on a monthly basis in this seminary. Every month, many Turkmen participants come here to take part in the competition and be judged by the Sunni masters. Mr. Niazi told me that many Quran reciters and memorizers find their ways to the national competitions through the competitions that are held rotationally every month in different parts of the regions. But as for the Turkman's livelihood, as I said, I went to one of the successful Turkman people, I mean Mr. Behruz Niazi. Mr. Behruz Niazi, unlike his family name, meaning a person who is in need, thanks to his years-long hard work and thank God, does not need worldly assets. He is one of the successful citizens of this city, Gombat Kavus. He has three children, and during the couple of days I stayed with them, I realized that he cares a lot about his family and loves them tremendously. Iranians have some traditions. It has a special place among all of them, and it's really important to observe them, like respecting their elders, especially their parents, or observing the Nowruz traditions or religious ceremonies or traveling. Turkmans are no exception. They love to travel. If the travel is to God's house, it is of utmost significance. This is Mr. Niazi, the senior, the elder in the Niazi family. He's Behruz Niazi's father. When a Turkman goes back home from the Hajj pilgrimage, the relatives hold a ceremony that is very interesting. They shower the Hajj pilgrims with nokl candles and cash, just like a bride and groom. They welcome them warmly. Afterwards, the Haji gives the guests some water from the Zamzam well as a holy souvenir. They stand facing towards the Qibla in Mecca and make a wish and drink the water so they become blessed with the water from the Zamzam and their wishes will be fulfilled. In small and large cities, there must be some places to shore up the economy of the region. This is the beating heart of Gombak Kavus's economy, an industrial township with 50 factories and workshops and 1,200 people who put food on the table by working in this place. In northeastern Iran, there are 3 dairy product factories that are modernized and facilitated with modern equipment. One of the factories belongs to Mr. Niazi that is located in the industrial township. 250 people directly work in it. The capacity of the factory is about 100 tons of milk per day. The products are loaded onto about 60 trucks on a daily basis. In all mythical stories we've heard since we were children and have passed on from generation to generation until today, there's always been a champion, or I'd better say, a hero, who's risen up to defend the oppressed people and save them from the tyranny of an oppressive ruler. Besides their swords and shields, the heroes had something else that was among the main characters in the stories, I mean, a horse. This spacious stable belongs to Mr. Niazi, where about 30 horses are kept, horses of renowned and good breed. Most of them are Turkmen. For example, Cobra, who's now become a little old. Some years ago, Cobra was among the winners of horse racing. Keeping these horses costs a lot, as well as purchasing them. They're bought at exorbitant prices. For example, this Australian giant. I didn't even dare get close to it. It seems only 2 or 3 people can ride it, and it doesn't like me that much. Turkmens have a good income through raising horses. There are 30 clubs and over 2,400 horses in Gombak Kavus. If each horse is valued at $40,000 only in the region of Turkmens, I mean northeast of Iran, the horses are worth $96,000. About noon that day, it was a Friday, we had the road to see another part of the city as well. I mean the Grand Mosque in Gombak. On our way to the Grand Mosque, I saw Sunni Turkmens who had put on their best clothes to join a spiritual gathering. The majority of the people in the city are Hanafi Sunnis. The Friday prayers in here, like other parts of Iran, are held very passionately. The prayers and the sermons by the Friday prayers leaders and the speeches by the guests were very interesting and effective. I said my prayers along with my Sunni brothers, alongside each other and facing towards the same Qibla. In northeastern Iran, a tribe lives that's known as Turkmen. They earn a living through hunting and raising cattle. Turkmen women and men are skillful horseback riders as well, who flaunt their skills with the purebred Turkmen horses on the green plains like the wind. These sentences are descriptions about the Turkmens in Iran, men and women who are fast horseback riders. This place is Gombak Kavus' horse racing track, a place that houses many horseback riders from all across the country and gathers everyone together. Like many big stadiums in the world, this place generates a lot of revenue. from the vendors to the horseback riders and the owners of the horses and the lucrative market of betting. The excitement in this place is indescribable. Women, men, young and old, get together in this place for their passions for the horses they somehow consider as theirs and hope their horses cross the finish line first. Up north, down south, back east, and out west of Iran are brimming with different cultures and traditions. The cultures that might be very different from each other, but they managed to live together for hundreds of years. Before packing up and moving towards Gombak Kavus, I was really worried. I was worried how I was going to come to terms with a completely different culture, or how a different culture could come to terms with a stranger like me. But after living with the Turkmans for 10 days, I managed to find many differences that did not exist between us. There's not much difference between me as a Shia who lives in Tehran and a Sunni person who lives in Gombak Kavus. We're both Muslims and pray facing towards the same Qibla, and we're both living in Iran, in a country like everywhere else in the world. The person who respects other people's beliefs achieves success and makes efforts to attain their goal. As a prominent Iranian poet, Saadi, says, "If you don't tolerate my pain, you won't get any treasure. He who worked got the wage."
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. Allah states that if people do not be His servant, then they have to be the servant of others. As we read in Ayah 39 of Surah Yusuf, are different masters better or Allah the One, the All Paramount? It is very much better to serve Allah rather than the creatures of Allah. Now, freedom is the fruit of servitude to Allah. You serve Allah and then become free,
from all the belongings and other types of servitudes. Therefore, all the prophets of Allah were sent to state that the only way to be free is servitude to Allah. The only path to freedom is servitude to Allah. In this way, we can be free from all the belongings of this world. Then we feel more comfortable in our life. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ranjbah. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Liz Truss has warned of tough times ahead after she scrapped her vast tax-cutting plan and said she would carry on to try to put the economy on a stronger footing. She defied calls for her resignation. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Liz Truss is facing cabinet unrest over her plans for brutal public spending cuts across all departments after a disastrous mini-budget put major pledges at risk, including the pensions triple lock. The Prime Minister held a 90-minute cabinet meeting on Tuesday, 18th of October, in which he warned ministers that difficult decisions lay ahead. The Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, told them everything is on the table, as he strives to find tens of billions of pounds in savings after ditching Truss's economic plan. Health, education and welfare are among those areas expected to be hit. One Whitehall official said departments were already preparing for cuts significantly higher than previously planned, with Jeremy Hunt's tax U-turns estimated to be set to raise £32 billion, leaving a £38 billion hole in the public finances. Liz Truss remains in a precarious position, having in effect handed power to Jeremy Hunt, with a YouGov poll showing that half of the Conservative members think she should resign. A significant majority would also support a coronation of a new Prime Minister by Tory MPs. Senior ministers are expected to capitalise on Liz Truss's weakness and resist deep cuts, with the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace indicating he would be prepared to quit his job if the Prime Minister does not honour her campaign pledge to spend 3% of gross domestic product or GDP on defence by 2030. She faces a humiliating Prime Minister's questions against Keir Starmer on Wednesday after one of the most dramatic U-turns in modern times. And number 10 Downing Street aides are concerned rebel Tory MPs could seize the moment to publicly call for her to go. Asked whether it was no longer a question of whether Liz Truss goes, but when she goes, the former Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove said, absolutely right. Whitehall officials said planned cuts drawn up before Kwasi Kwarteng was sacked, but now paused, in which departments would make capital savings of 10% to 15%, and day-to-day savings of at least 2% were now likely to be more brutal. It is fair to say that things are looking tougher than they were, one said. Every department is going to have to play a role in finding efficiencies. No department will be ring-fenced. Government sources confirmed the existing three-year spending review would not be rewritten, but said savings would be required within that because of inflation. In the next spending round from 2024 to 2025, spending is expected to fall dramatically. Jeremy Hunt told ministers they would be asked to find ways to save money, with a focus on areas that would not affect public services. He will meet each one this week to thrash out figures, which will be submitted to the Office for Budget Responsibility on Friday. Late on Tuesday, The Times reported that Jeremy Hunt is poised to delay Boris Johnson's flagship social care reform and has been warned that his spending cuts may have to be tougher even than George Osborne's era of austerity. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. British Prime Minister Liz Truss warned of tough times ahead after she scrapped her vast tax-cutting plan and said she would carry on to try to put the economy on a stronger footing, defying calls for her resignation. After weeks of blaming global headwinds for investors dumping the pound and government bonds, Liz Truss on Monday, 17th of October, said she was sorry for going too far too fast with her radical economic plan to snap Britain out of years of tepid growth. It was not clear whether the apology would quell a growing rebellion in her own Conservative Party, with a handful of lawmakers urging Truss to quit just 6 weeks after she became Prime Minister. Liz Truss has said she will fight on and told her top ministers she wanted to level with the public that there would be tough times ahead. A new YouGov opinion poll showed that even among Conservative Party members who backed her for Prime Minister, more than half of those polled said she should resign. A third wanted her predecessor Boris Johnson to return. Markets, which plunged after Liz Truss's 23rd of September mini-budget, are still under strain, even after her Finance Minister, Jeremy Hunt, tore up her plans on Monday. "I do want to accept responsibility and say I'm sorry for the mistakes that have been made," Truss told the BBC in an interview on Monday. "I wanted to act to help people with their energy bills, to deal with the issue of high taxes, but we went too far too fast." Truss said she was sticking around and that she would lead the Conservatives into the next election due in about 2 years' time, although the statement was accompanied by a laugh. Earlier on Monday, Liz Truss went to the Parliament as Jeremy Hunt ripped up the plan she proposed less than a month ago, and which triggered a bond market rout so deep that the Bank of England had to act to prevent pension funds from collapsing. For some in the Conservative Party, the sight of the Prime Minister humbled in Parliament provided little confidence that she could carry on. James Hippie, a minister for the armed forces, said Liz Truss, his boss, could not afford to make any more mistakes. Truss spoke to her Brexit-supporting lawmakers on Tuesday, promising to resolve the contentious rules that govern trade with Northern Ireland, and said she was still a low-tax Conservative who would pursue such goals more slowly. One of those present said she was received warmly, in contrast to more hostile receptions from other wings of the party. Members of Parliament have been urged by government to hold off from any move to oust her before it presents its medium-term fiscal plan on 31st of October. Liz Truss was elected by Conservative Party members, not the broader electorate, on a promise to slash taxes and regulation to fire up the economy, in a policy dubbed by critics as a return to 1980s Thatcherite-style trickle-down economics. But markets reacted so dramatically that borrowing costs surged, lenders pulled mortgage offers, and pension funds fell into a tailspin.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Allah, 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 All
are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography, and we'll be back. Don't go away. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. We are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about some of the Islamic laws on our IRIB English Radio about the medical issues, let me ask you this question. It is somehow related to some of the previous questions in the previous programs, and because of the shortage of time, we couldn't afford to ask those questions. We were talking about IVF, for example, scenarios, or surrogate or surrogacy and surrogate mother, whether it's Islamically permissible or not. So for those of you who are interested to know the answers, we advise you actually to go back to our previous programs to listen to them. I'd like to ask you this question in this program that, some childless couples get separated, and mainly because of the strains and stresses they feel because of the marriage, and due to the fact that the wife is, for example, barren, right, and infertile, and because of the ovulation, for example, problems. Sure. So is it permissible, Islamically speaking, to use an egg donated by another woman, right, to carry out the fertilization procedure in a tube, for example, by the husband's sperms, and the implantation of the fertilized eggs in the wife's womb?
Okay, great question. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no legal objection or problem in carrying out the said procedure in itself. But the born child belongs to the genetic parents. The genetic parents are the parents who gave sperm and eggs. They are the genetic parents. And therefore, it is problematic. There is objection in referring the baby to the mother who became pregnant with it. You know, the mother who, in whose womb, for example, the child grew up and then turned and evolved into a child is not the mother, according to His Eminence. And there is a problem in referring, you know, that child to that mother. You know, Ayatollah Khamenei, just as I said in one of the previous answers to the previous questions, they should observe caution, ihtiyat, insofar as the Shari rules governing lineage are concerned. You know, the issue becomes a little bit complicated because on the one hand, the mother who became pregnant with the child is not a mother according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And then the mother is the woman who gave eggs to be fertilized with the sperm of the man, the husband.
Mm-hmm.
And the husband is the husband of the man, of the woman who became pregnant with the child. So there is confusion, you know. Ayatollah Khamenei says at the end of the day, you have to exercise precaution and you must do whatever that you make sure that the child goes back to the parents, to the genetical, to the genetic parents, and the child belongs to those parents.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our questions around the medical issues in this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Jadal, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the Islamic laws on medical issues, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh Tawid, is it permissible to use the sperm of the husband after his death? You know, some people actually freeze their sperm.
Sure.
In fertilizing an egg taken from his wife and implanted inside her womb. So one question is that whether it is permissible or not. And the other question is that does this child belong to the dead husband and also inherit from the father?
That's a good question. And this is a current question also, because this is the time in which science and technology have improved and have advanced to such an extent where the father may not be alive, but still he is giving, he is procreating even after his death. So Ayatollah Khamenei says that there is no harm in carrying out the procedure in itself. It is permissible in and of itself, of course. The born child belongs to the mother to whom the egg and the womb belong.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it belongs to the mother. Now, Ayatollah Khamenei says that it is not remote to attribute the baby to the husband. So it's not very much unlikely
mm-hmm.
that the child may belong to the to the husband who is no longer alive, but he's dead. But the sperm still belongs to that man who is dead. So he says that it's not far from likely that the child belongs to the same husband who's dead and to whom the sperm belongs. But you know, when it comes to inheritance, whether the child inherits his father and does he receive anything from the property left by the deceased father or not, Ayatollah Khamenei says that the baby does not inherit anything from his deceased father.
Mm-hmm. I see.
He does not.
Okay. And, you know, Sheikh Tawbit, is it permissible for a woman whose husband is sterile?
Yes.
To be artificially inseminated with a sperm from a non-mahram man, other than her husband, of course. In other words, through placing a sperm in her womb. And does it matter if it is not her womb and then this fertilization is done, in fact, in a test tube?
When it comes to the preliminary steps, which are, of course, haram, like, you know, looking and touching, there is no doubt that, you know, these are the steps, the preliminary steps, which are haram. Ayatollah Khamenei says that there is no legal impediment to inseminating a woman with the sperm of a non-mahram man, but if it is, you know, if it does not involve, you know, if it does not involve haram preliminaries, like, for example, if it's done outside the in a laboratory, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the born child in this way does not belong to the husband of the woman, rather to the person who donated the sperm, and the woman whose eggs and womb were used in the process, you know. This is the answer given by His Eminence in his book Ajwibatul Istifta'at, which says that, of course, if it does not include any haram preliminaries like looking and touching, and of course, you know, seeing the private parts, and if these things are not involved, if these things are not included, then there is no objection. But you know, there is no doubt that such looking and touching are there, and mm-hmm. it cannot, you know, the fertilization or the insemination cannot take place without looking and touching.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Abid, for your nice answers. Well, thank you for listening to our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم مجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.